From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. 100 years ago, the United States was the strapping new kid on the block. The U.S. went on to dominate the world economy in what came to be known as the American century. Now it looks like China's turn to soar, and Americans have barely begun to come to grips with what that means. Tonight on Point, China and the new face of global economic power. We turn first tonight to Baghdad, where a car bomb exploded this morning, killing at least 10 people and injuring 40 others. Thanasi Kambanis is a Boston Globe correspondent in Iraq and is covering the bombing. I asked him how Iraqis are reacting to the news of the first major bombing since the country's interim government took power.
Well, it was interesting because a lot of people I talked to today were angry at the attackers. There was the usual parade of folks who blamed this attack, as usual, on the Americans, and weaved complicated conspiracy theories. But in the hospital today, the folks I talked to were furious at what they saw as an attack against innocent Iraqi civilians. And you have to understand who the victims of today's bombing were. They were largely Iraqis who live and work in or near the Green Zone, who were lined up at the security checkpoint to get in. And this was the checkpoint leading to the Iraqi government, not to the U.S. Headquarters or the British Embassy. So one of the folks was a guy who sells cell phones. One was a recently enrolled anti-American Iraqi military officer who had just rejoined the army a few days ago after the transfer of sovereignty. So these were folks who saw themselves in no way as affiliated with occupation or with foreigners, and suddenly they're being targeted by a suicide bomb. There was a lot of outrage about that and a lot of sense of the tide turning against the people that even the Iraqis were calling terrorists.
After 2 weeks of relative calm, terrible scenes today of body parts smeared and torn clothing. Exactly what happened, Thanasi?
Well, before 9 o'clock this morning, a van packed with explosives pulled into this quite busy checkpoint, and they were stopped by the first layer of guards, who were all Iraqis, and asked to show a badge. They didn't have the appropriate kind of badge, and when they were instructed to turn around, that's when they rushed the car forward and set off the detonator. The majority of the victims were the group of pedestrians lined up right next to the road at the same checkpoint. About 5 cars were incinerated, and one of these enormous concrete blast barriers was hit with such force by the explosion that it actually tilted over. These things are enormous and heavy. I mean, it takes a lot of force to knock one of them over.
What does this do to the brave face that the new interim Iraqi government has put on in the last couple of weeks? They've acted tough, hopeful, aggressive, and now a major blast right at their front door.
I think for Iyad Alawi, the strategy he's taken is tough words and presumably tough action when he finds suspects that he can round up. And I don't think this in of itself interferes with that plan at all. Again, unlike any Iraqi official we saw during the interim period, he was right on the scene after this explosion happened, saying, "We will bring to justice the people who did this. This is an attack against the Iraqi people." He was front and center, right by the crater. He's done this in every major bombing that we've seen, in fact, since he was first nominated on June 1st. And the other thing, this comes in the same week that his government has gone on a major roundup of criminal suspects. So 2 days ago, they arrested about 500 suspected terrorists, mobsters, kidnappers, carjackers, and ostentatiously put them on display at a temporary prison in the Ministry of Interior in a clearly choreographed way of signaling the Iraqi people that they are getting tough on crime. So for him, this is not necessarily a setback. It will be a setback if attacks like this start to happen with the regularity that they were in early June.
And yet the bombing was not the only violence today. Gunmen killed a senior official at the industry ministry in Baghdad and, very interestingly, reportedly killed the governor of the northern city of Mosul, Yusuf Khashmollah, as he was driving south toward Baghdad. What happened there?
We only have sketchy reports of it. That's about what we know. According to the interior ministry, attackers using just machine guns, no grenades or missiles, attacked this convoy and killed the governor as well as 2 of his guards. And that was about 60 miles south of Mosul on a road that's been notoriously unsafe for about the last 4 months. little noticed over the last couple of weeks have been the consistent continuing attacks against Iraqi government officials, including the governors and deputy governors of the province where Bakuba is, who have been attacked. So far, none of them have been seriously injured or killed. Also in Baghdad, we had an attempted assassination of the head of the Olympic Committee 2 days ago. So the targeting of government officials both in Baghdad and the province has continued unabated. They've simply been less successful in the attacks lately.
Tanasi, with these attacks today, is it possible to assess the capacity of the interim government to get on top of this problem of violence and killings? The words have been strong. They've taken some strong actions, but are they up to the task of quelling this insurgency, this terrorism?
To go out on a limb, or I guess not much of a limb, I think it's pretty clear that they're not really in a position where they can find and identify and arrest terror networks, foreign fighters, or insurgent leaders. I mean, you can bet that if they had arrested a single obvious leader of this, they would have trotted them out and been quite public about it. They're just starting to build an intelligence service. The problems with the police are well documented. The new army is only now starting to take any shape and any strength. I think the police just last week finally deployed their first couple of hundred SWAT team members. They really don't have the infrastructure or the manpower to do much more than perimeter security. So what's changed is that more Iraqis are in the position where they're going to die when things like today's suicide bomb happened, because up until a month ago, it would have been American soldiers at that checkpoint. Now it was Iraqis. What impact that will have on the public perception is, you can imagine, it will change the public reaction. But in answer to your question, I don't think they're anywhere close to having the resources to be front and center in this fight.
Tanasi Kambanis, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Tom.
Tanasi Kambanis is a correspondent for the Boston Globe. He spoke with us from Baghdad. A century ago, long dominant Europe was on the cusp of a bewildering adjustment to an irresistible new reality, the surging global economic impact of the United States. Now, in the 21st century, the U.S. may be approaching a radical status shift of its own, a century in which it may play Europe's second fiddle role to a powerfully ascendant Chinese economy. Tonight on Point, China on a roll that is just beginning. Are you tuned in to the overwhelming scale of China's economic big bang? Is there anything that Americans can do today that China won't do quicker or cheaper tomorrow? How will America learn to live with surging China? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Chicago is Ted Fishman, a contributing editor to Harper's Magazine. His recent cover story in the New York Times Magazine is The Chinese Century. Good evening and welcome, Ted Fishman.
Glad to be here. Thank you.
It's great to have you. And with me in the studio tonight is On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly Magazine. Jack, great to have you right here.
Nice to be here, Tom.
Ted Fishman, a terrific piece that we're still thinking about 2 weeks later in the Times Magazine. You really laid it out in a compelling fashion. There's a lot we want to get into with you tonight. Orville Schell will join us later.
Great.
But let me just put it to you first at this level. The headline on your piece, The Chinese Century, there's a lot loaded into those three words. What is meant by that? What do you mean by that?
I don't mean anything different than the Chinese mean by it, and they're very open with it when you're traveling through China. The idea is that their country has been out of the mainstream for most of the last century, but for most of human history, they were the richest, most powerful nation in the world, and they see that as their rightful place, and they're working like heck to get there.
And what's the dynamic, or what will be the evidence as we move forward in this century that it is indeed the Chinese century? What's the foundation laid down now? How is it likely to unfold?
Well, I think one thing that we'll think increasingly about is, how is China in our lives when we wake up in the morning? I think, Tom, when most of the world wakes up in the morning today, they think, well, what will the United States put on my plate today? What kind of products will I see? What kind of cultural information will come my way? How will the political landscape be affected by what's happening in Washington and around the U.S.? Not too long from now, we'll be thinking, what's going to come my way because of what's happening in China? It's happening in all kinds of ways already that we might not think too seriously about, but we ought to. When you look around what's in your shopping cart when you come home from virtually any store in the United States, there's a lot of the Chinese century in your shopping basket.
Ted, what's the give us a sense of the scale of the economic surge and the dynamics of that surge underway in China now?
Well, as you know, China went from being almost universally the country of the poorest people on the planet, and now it is the most rapidly growing economy of all the biggest economies in the world. And for a long time, it's had, I would say over the last 10 years, it has had remarkable economic growth, which has pulled it into the ranks of all of the world's leading economies. The CIA itself puts the Chinese economy somewhere between that of the United States and Japan, which is a remarkable achievement considering they weren't even a player 20 years ago.
Remarkable, and in many, many dimensions, as you describe it, just getting going. At the same time, our reaction to it, China's understanding of itself is loaded with contradictions. Can you lay out some of those contradictions for us, Ted?
Well, one of the most interesting for me is that as the country becomes more global, as its fortunes become more intertwined with those of us and with the rest of the world, it is also becoming more nationalistic. So it's asserting itself in a Chinese way. At the very same time, it needs the world to prosper. One of the most interesting things is the role shift in the world that the United States and China have undergone. You know, the U.S. used to be the country that pushed the status quo, that wanted everything to be stable, that was the most in favor of open markets. Now, if you look at the world, China has, which used to be the radical player, the most vehemently anti-business, is now the one with the biggest stake in things being just the way they are. They are doing extremely well right now in the world, and they don't want the United States to upset the apple cart too much. And you can see that diplomatically. You can see that in their business negotiations. You can see that in almost everything they do. They are the country which wants to be seen as the reasonable player, as the status quo player.
And then there's this whole series of contradictions that you list beyond that. China, one moment looking like the greatest threat to the U.S., the next like the U.S. greatest friend. China siphoning off American jobs. China, at the same time, essential to the U.S. competitive edge. China as the world's factory floor, but also as the world's greatest market opportunity, back and forth on so many fronts.
Yeah, if you look at the news over the last year, I think you can see how the Chinese century is starting to percolate. There's virtually no major trend in the world in which the press hasn't tied it back to China. The loss of jobs, the promise of our exports, the deflation in the world, inflation in the world, the price of our consumer goods going down, the price of our raw materials going up, the price of oil at the pump, that's a China problem. It works both ways on almost every single issue. The truth of the matter is that, big countries and big economies do offer the world contradictions, and trends do work both ways with China. And that is one of the hardest things to grasp about this very big, very dynamic country, is that it works in ways that are often at odds against each other.
Jack Beatty, here it is. It's in the air. It's everywhere. China on the march. A century ago, it was the United States, here, a very new player.
Yes, and there's a cloud of darkness over it, unfortunately. The China price, the low price of goods, has blood all over it. China labor practices combine some of the worst features of communist tyranny, capitalist exploitation, and the Indian caste system. Chinese factory workers live under conditions described by neutral researchers as bestial, horrific, and abominable. They're paid less than their own legal minimum wage. Sometimes they're not paid at all. Death by overworking, they have a word for it. Their rate of industrial death and limbs loss exceeds any in history. Since 1989, Chinese workers have tried to organize within their own system. They have been met with the following responses: machine gun fire, beatings, police harassment, forced labor, forced relocation to impoverished regions, detention without trial, psychiatric internment, forced electroshock therapy, on and on and on.
On it goes. Jack Beatty, not putting out the Chinese flag. Ted Fishman, describing a big new sun coming up. Listeners, listeners, you can join our conversation tonight. We're talking about China in the new face of world economic power. Are you tuned in to the overwhelming scale of the Chinese economic Big Bang? On balance, does America gain or lose from China's ascent? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about China and the new face of world economic power. You can join our conversation tonight. Are Americans, are you prepared to live in the Chinese century? Are you aware of all the ways in which the Chinese economy already surrounds you? And will 21st century America be to China as 20th century Europe was to the United States? Still rich, but no longer the main dynamo. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined tonight from Chicago by Ted Fishman, contributing editor at Harper's Magazine and author of the recent terrific cover story in the Times Magazine entitled The Chinese Century. Ted Fishman, Jack Beatty's laying out a bill of condemnation on China here as the great kind of bugaboo to all things humane and labor.
Well, one of the ironies about China is what it tells us about the blueprint for the world that the United States has promoted for the last 10 or 15 years, the so-called Washington Consensus, where we went around the world and we told any country willing to listen that they ought to democratize, that they ought to liberalize their markets, that they ought to get the rule of law. We proposed this very effectively and used it with our many of the world's big financial organizations like the World Bank or the International Monetary Fund. And if you look at the countries that followed it, many in Latin America, they were worse at the end of the 20-year period of the Washington Consensus than they were at the beginning. Well, now you look at China's development. Have they democratized? Not really. Listen to what Jack Beatty said. Have they liberalized? Certainly not. There are lots of trade barriers there. Do they have the rule of law? No. And yet now they are the envy of the rest of the developing world. So what does that mean for our blueprint for the rest of the world? Where does the world look to for its model?
That is a huge question. But Jack Beatty, let me put it to you. I mean, that is unsettling. At the same time, when I hear you rattling off that outraged list, you know, I can imagine it sounding a little bit like an outraged Britain or Belgian in 1904, upset at this upstart America and its dark, demonic steel mills and its terrible labor practices and its general affront to civilized Europe.
In fact, our workers were always paid a margin better than European workers, and our protectionism assured that. We didn't import lower standards of living because we didn't import low-cost goods. The American standard of living was defended. You know, this is all the cruelties, the denial of basic human dignity, the lack of living up to their own laws. This lowers Chinese wages by from 47% to 86%, according to some estimates. That is, if China didn't repress, kill, torture, exile to the country people who tried to organize unions, their wages, the standard of living for Chinese workers would rise by 0.5% to 86%. And of course, the unfair advantage that gives to Chinese prices, that is to say, the repression premium in those prices has been estimated to be as high as 43% in export goods.
So that's a big premium. But Ted Fishman, we can hear how Jack looks at it. How do, and this is unfair, there are 1.5 billion Chinese, but overall in China, are they more thrilled with the advance of their economy, inequitably distributed as it may be, or more upset over continuing elements of labor exploitation or downright repression?
Well, I have to say that in my travels in China that the place seems very buoyant, that people seem very optimistic, and it may be all a measure of what they faced in the past. These are people that have come out of even a worse time. They have in the back of their minds the chaos of the Cultural Revolution, which was hell on earth. My analysis of what is keeping wages low in China might be a little bit different than Jack's, and it's that there are tens, hundreds of millions of unemployed in China looking for work. Just in the east coast of China, there is what is called this huge mass of floating workers, the floating population. And these are people who have left the countryside in the tens of millions and are looking for something better than the farm jobs or the farms that they've left, which offered them virtually no income whatsoever. And the size of this population is equal to the entire labor force of the United States and Europe combined. And they are all looking for work.
And it's just waiting to be tapped, and it's not asking for big wages. Let's bring in a couple of other vectors here. First of all, we're talking about a big Chinese ascent, but the fact is, as you point out, that the U.S. economy remains eight times the size of China's, the U.S. manufacturing sector bigger than the entire Chinese economy. Americans per capita earn 36 times what the Chinese do. Does that mean that the United States has such a lead that the notion of it being overtaken by China is either paranoid or too optimistic, depending how you look at it?
Well, it's informed by how quickly the growth in China is happening. They have numbers that if you do the math, and if they stay at all close to them, if they grow 9% a year, then they will soon equal our economy. When you look at China, it pays to look beyond just what one worker in the U.S. is making versus one worker in China is making, because the country is so huge. There are different populations, and it pays to think of them as different nations. They can have a middle class, which is the size of the entire United States. They can have an upper class, which is the size of our wealthy class. And you don't need everyone in the country to match our per capita income in order for them to match us as an economy.
And then there's this. No country has an absolutely open road, clear sailing. As you point out, the poor or minorities in China could rebel against these inequities. Taiwan or North Korea could push China to war. The United States could slap taxes on everything that China ships to us, as you say. But your conclusion, in spite of all those potential pitfalls for China, Ted Fishman, is that, as you say, nothing is likely to keep China down for long. Why so sanguine in spite of some substantial potential pitfalls?
Well, if you look at the progress of the United States over the long haul, we have had lots of setbacks. And you could look at the United States in the 1930s and say we were going nowhere in the future. But if you look at the long drift, then it's been very positive for us, and we've done extremely well. I think when you think about China, you have to look at the long drift. There might be periods of repression. There might be periods of natural disaster. There might be periods of political chaos. But over the long haul, there's a lot of energy in the country, and people just aren't going to go back.
Ted Fishman, Jack Beatty, stand by. I want to welcome into our conversation from Berkeley, California, Orville Schell. He's a longtime China watcher, dean of the Graduate School of Journalism at the University of California at Berkeley, and author of, among many other books, Mandate of Heaven, The Legacy of Tiananmen Square and the Next Generation of China's Leaders. Good evening and welcome, Orville Schell.
Good evening.
It's great to have you with us. Orville, I'm sure that you read Ted's piece with great interest and you followed the whole debate and anticipation and waves of disappointment alternating for years over China. How do you look at this Chinese century idea right now? Do you see an ascendant China in the making that is going to overcome, just by dint of demographics and vigor, whatever may be thrown in its path and come to challenge or even supersede the U.S.?
Well, I think in any scenario, China will figure very large in what happens sort of in global markets and politics in the future. It's interesting just listening to this conversation because, in a sense, we have a contradiction in the conversation itself. And as Mao Zedong was very careful to point out, there is a certain unity in contradictions. In fact, he loved to understand the world through the notion of contradictions.
The yin-yang here.
Yin and yang would be the traditional sort of mode of this thinking. So I think that in actuality today, that is the only way to make sense of this place. It is repressive. It has terrible human rights records. It's a kind of a Leninist capitalism. And from a certain perspective, it shouldn't work. But yet, in an amazing way, it has worked. It's filled with energy, dynamism. It's done a sort of a development gymnastic that is almost unbelievable, and nobody would have predicted. But I think one has to point out that inherent within this very dynamic proposition are immense instabilities. And this is a country of enormous significance, but of also an enormous well of unresolved issues that depart from the most fundamental of what kind of system does it have and what kind of system does it want to have, where is it going, how does it integrate the past with the future, how is a free market going to finally reconcile itself with a closed political system, and one could go on and on and on and on and on. And that, it seems to me, is going to make the China ride into the future a very interesting one, and I would say also one problematic, where very opposite scenarios are almost equally plausible.
But does economic growth and the excitement that that breeds overwhelm all of that, or do you see the real possibility of a crack-up out there? Ted Fishman looks at U.S. history and says, look, in the century when it was all lined up for growth, despite 21 recessions and a Great Depression and stock market crashes and world wars, it surged anyway. Is China poised to sort of inevitably surge here, or are there real sort of show-stopping problems that it may confront?
Well, if I could answer that question, I would probably be in the investment community. But I think it's smart to remember that even though the long perspective may be somewhat bright or quite bright for China, look what happened to Japan. Remember when it could do no wrong, and then it had a decade of the doldrums. Look at the five tigers in Southeast Asia. I think we forget at our peril that even the most vibrant, dynamic, and impressive economies always tend to be cyclical.
But if China got anywhere near the economic status in terms of per capita income, let's say, of the Asian tigers or Japan, that would be a global economic earthquake.
Well, it would, but it's kind of, you know, this is a long way off, and to get there, there are a number of things other than just more manufacturing that will have to come into play. And these are the very parts of the Chinese puzzle which I think the leadership seems ill-disposed to tackle and actually has very little idea of how they should be tackled, and so they tend to sort of not talk about them in any major sort of public way, at least, although private people talk about them all the time.
So, Ted Fishman, how do you see these obstacles then? Do you see China as being focused and smart, clever, reformist enough to get over them? Or are you just anticipating the kind of natural energy of a rising nation is going to surge right over the problems?
Well, I think for me, what's more important is the whole country focused, and is the whole country in order, is whether there are enough people in China who are focused and who will be a challenge to us. What is really important for the United States is to think about how we will adjust to a world in which either the Chinese themselves are rich or poor, or the Chinese themselves have their political act together and have geopolitical clout, but which either way that goes, it is going to present a challenge to us. If China has an economic collapse, workers will be paid less in China and goods will be even cheaper for the United States. No matter which way it goes, we have a country which is going to be producing more and more and throwing more and more challenges our way. And for us, to prepare for that future, we have to think about what is our best game plan, how do we mind our game the best. And fretting over human rights abuse is something that's worthwhile to do in a political way. But there's nothing we can do that will stop the productive might of the Chinese from throwing more goods onto our shores, filling our shelves with more things, and becoming smarter and smarter as they work up the technological chain and taking their place among, you know, the best producing nations in the world.
We're going to look at more angles of that, but I want to begin to welcome our callers in. We're at 1-800-423-8255. Michael is calling from Sudbury, Massachusetts. Hi, Michael. You're on the air.
Hi. I just wanted to inject one skeptical note talking about the Chinese century. And it's based, and also the comparison with the United States, and it's based on the fact that we had something that China doesn't have. And that's really important, and that's political legitimacy. We had a constitution, and we had consensus, you know, about the American government. China, seems to me to have practically none of that. They're terribly skittish. Every Taiwanese election has thrown a virtual panic into the leadership. They shelled the Taiwanese coastal areas after the first one. They issued blood-curdling threats after the second one. And, it's no wonder. Chen Shui-bian, the Taiwanese leader, can say he was elected by 20 million Taiwanese. Who elected you, Mr. Hu Jintao? And, you know, you could just go on endlessly. I mean, there's this Dr. Zhang, who many Chinese regard as a hero for having really nipped the SARS epidemic
yes.
in the bud.
Mm.
And he's been in prison now for, you know, a month and a half.
But, Michael, what's your – do you think that these things could come in and really stop the party? Or I'll put the same question to you I put to Ted Fishman. Is the thrill of economic growth so great for a country that's been poor for so long that it's just going to override these issues, as large as they may be?
Well, I mean, maybe theoretically, if economic growth just went straight upward like a rocket, that would be true, but it never happens. I mean,
yeah.
the fact what political legitimacy does for you is it gets you through a Great Depression. I mean, China has not conquered the business cycle. They're going to
mm-hmm.
have downturns.
Mm-hmm.
And who is going to believe that that government should stay in power when their wages are cut or they're thrown out of work? I mean, there are reports of widespread labor disturbances, but that's in a condition of prosperity and growth. Imagine if they were much bigger and the Chinese government couldn't just buy off individual workers' groups.
A real down cycle and unemployed or underpaid people in the masses in the streets. Michael, you raise a lot of great points there. Jack Beatty, okay, here's maybe the underbelly, the vulnerability, if you want to look at the big one. This, as Michael puts it, a lack of consensus, even a lack of political legitimacy.
Yes, and I thought he put it very interestingly. I mean, this skittishness about Taiwan, that is an elected government. And what does legitimacy give a regime? Well, as he says, it gives it staying power in a crisis. But it also means that the regime can carry through, and it legitimates itself by carrying through on its own promises to its people. It now keeps no promises it makes. It now has minimum wage standards that it violates. It now has safety standards that it pays no attention to. It now has, you know, conditions about how workers should live, which are, would all sound good in theory, but they're not legitimate.
But
they
hasn't
don't have
it
to pay
kept
any
its core
to.
Promise, which in a way still goes back right now to Deng Xiaoping in the early 80s, saying, it doesn't matter if the cat is white or black, as long as it catches the mouse, as long as it brings home the economic performance. Isn't that its fundamental promise right now?
No, not if it's on the basis of one of the most wholesale deprivals of human rights in human history. And, of course, it exports its standard of living all over the world.
But
China,
what about,
if it's the China century, God help us.
But what about Ted Fishman's point?
Will go down.
But Ted looks at the democracies pushed by the Washington consensus in Latin America and elsewhere and says, hey, they're not exactly prospering. Chinese are not blind to this. The Chinese citizens, they look around the world and need to say, perhaps, and say, you know what, freedom's lousy here, but look at our growth and look at theirs.
Well, I mean, and people in the Soviet Union said similar things in the 1930s when they were having their, you know, forced industrialization. And no doubt under Mao, there were periods of, well, by gosh, our autarkic economy is better than the whole world's. But the fact remains, because of the size of the Chinese economy, there's no comparison with Latin America. China is a threat to standards of living all over the world.
Ted Fishman, Orville Schell, Jack Beatty, please stand by. We're talking tonight about China and the new face of world economic power. You can join the conversation. Is the new Chinese century inevitable? Is it vulnerable? If everything gets recalibrated to the China price, what's left for America's affluence? And are you excited by the rising China, or are you scared, or are you both? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about China and the new face of world economic power. We're joined tonight from Chicago by Ted Fishman, contributing editor at Harper's Magazine and author of the recent cover story in the Times Magazine, The Chinese Century. Orville Schell is with us from Berkeley, California. He's author of Mandate of Heaven and a longtime China watcher. Jack Beatty's here as well, and you are welcome to join us. Are you investing in China? Are you studying Mandarin? What's the best strategy for American response to China rising? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Dick is calling from Wauwatosa, Wisconsin. Hi, Dick. You're on the air.
Yes, hi.
Oh.
This is a financial services question.
Okay.
Historically, the U.S. financial services sector, everything from investment banking, mortgage banking, has been a substantial driver of the U.S. economy.
Yeah.
Here, and it's been, you know, certainly a leader overseas. Where do your guests see the financial services entree of China, both now and in the future?
You mean an American role there, or the Chinese role abroad as their bankroll grows?
The Chinese rule abroad as their bankroll grows.
Got it. Dick, thanks very much. Ted Fishman, what do you say to that?
I don't have a good answer to that. The Chinese banking system is such a god-awful mess that they're probably not going to give Citibank or Chase Manhattan a run for their money anytime soon. But the powerhouses in American finance are beating a hasty path to China's door, and they want to provide the services that China's banks cannot. And what you might see ultimately is some sort of buy-in from a large Chinese financial institution, probably with ties to the central government, buying into an international player in financial services and asserting themselves that way. But this is something that we will have a lead in for a long time to come.
Now, Chinese capital, how significant a role is it playing now in the U.S. stock market, in supporting the U.S. dollar? How much is coming back to the United States?
That's huge. The Chinese underwrite a huge amount of our economy. They buy a lot of our debt. They keep their currency low, which in effect provides a direct subsidy from the Chinese citizen to the American consumer. If the Chinese government decides to let their currency float and it goes up, then they are no longer paying for that extra depression in Chinese currency and everything made in China.
But as for financial services, you see that flowing the other way for now, from the U.S. to China. Let's get another call. Easley is calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hi, Easley. You're on the air.
Yes. I'm an architect with significant interests in China, mm-hmm. and it seems to me that your show is particularly opportune. The Chinese are acutely aware of the success that we have in the U.S., and I think we have a reciprocal obligation to be both aware and responsible in our strategy of assisting the Chinese. To me, it's not competition. It really ought to be cooperation.
And you don't see a prize to America in China's growth, abutting Chinese affluence. You see mutual benefit.
I see mutual benefit. I see it particularly to the Chinese, but I see it also to U.S. businesses like my own.
With a lot of business, we've seen how the Chinese love to build, an incredible building boom going on there, not in business, in residential. Let me ask you easily, though, on what Jack Beattie has pointed to on the kind of labor and political underside. Does that give you pause at all, or are you supporting Chinese economic growth in the kind of confidence that it will eventually lead to political liberalization?
Well,
or don't
I'm
you care?
Hopeful. I'm hopeful about the latter. Every burgeoning economy, I believe, has a rather dark underside. We heard reports on Russia earlier tonight on NPR, and there are certainly those undersides to China, as there have been in our own economy. But for us to stand aside and to look askance at all of the negatives without recognizing the incredible opportunities that the man and woman on the street in not only Shanghai and Beijing, but in smaller, out-of-the-way cities and communities have enjoyed over the last 25 years in China, I think is short-sighted on our part.
Easily may I ask the caller
if
you are building in China? Do you have projects in China?
Yes.
And what kind of projects are they?
Largely planning and mixed use.
The construction industry is a good example of Orville Schell's wonderful outlook, whereas you could put every trend in China on a page and they would all be true.
meaning what, Ted Fishman?
Well, the construction boom is a boom, and it is creating a lot of wealth, but it is creating the wealth on the backs of migrant workers who are coming in from the countryside who live on site as buildings are built, move from site to site, really have no home. And
not like American agriculture in California.
That's absolutely true. However, those people might otherwise be on the streets in front of the train stations and airports.
No, agreed. Agreed. And if you look at the ratio, maybe you probably have better insight into this than I do, but if you look at the ratio of material costs versus labor costs in China and how they relate to the same ratio in the United States, decades ago in the United States, labor would have been a very minimal cost in building buildings, and we had grand, ornate buildings that made New York City and Philadelphia and Chicago look the way they do. And in China now, you have labor costs being very minimal in relation to the whole cost of buildings, and they are building fantastic structures that would not find a home anywhere else.
That Shanghai skyline and others, we've seen them. They are incredible. Jack Beatty, what about Easley's point? He's saying, hey, let's share and share alike on the opportunity front here. We have no natural right to affluence. You know, development is never exactly pretty. For all you've said, America's had plenty of darkness in it. So give China some room to run.
Yeah, but I'm worried about our manufacturers. Let's get some customers over there. Consider these two statistics. In the last decade, the U.S. trade deficit with China grew by 353%. Meanwhile, Chinese exports grew by 300%. Now, what's the result over here? Well, unemployment in employment in textile industries fallen by 50%, in apparel by two-thirds, in aerospace by 47% in the decade, in electrical equipment by 22%, in machinery by 21%. I can go on. Suppose the Chinese paid the 43% premium, 43 to 80% decrement, that is the repressive decrement in their wages. Suppose they actually paid that to their workers.
Still be way shy of American wages.
Oh, absolutely, but they could then buy our goods. As it is now, with a 353% increase in our trade deficit, there are no customers for our goods there because they're not being paid.
Well, this is a very complicated thing, because if you look at the Chinese trade as a whole, it's on balance. They do not have a large trade deficit or surplus, and they are buying very high-value goods from Japan and from Germany.
And you say, Ted Fishman, that the growing place of China in a global economy cannot be legislated away with tariffs, quotas, or tax incentives for struggling industries. Why not?
Well, one reason is that we live in a world in where there's infinite economic arbitrage, and if we take action that stymies the Chinese here, they will do business somewhere else. If the Chinese take action that stymie us, we will go somewhere else. And you have this trailing effect around the world that stopgap measures here and there cannot get in the way of.
And Orville Schell, what about our caller Easley's view that we need to make running room for China? Of course, let them be affluent, and why not? We should have no natural entitlement to it. Do you see a conflict between that and what Americans would probably like to see in political terms in China?
Well, I don't think we have any choice in the global world in which we live. I do think, however, that you know, men do not live by money and manufacture alone. And I think we commit a real mistake if we assume that somehow the Chinese are different, that they don't need culture, they don't need elections, they don't need free religion, they don't need free expression. There is a certain kind of, I think, paternalism implicit in that view. I think also it's a bit naive to think that ipso facto open markets will ultimately equal an open society. We look at fascism. I mean, it certainly didn't there. So it's very difficult to know what America should do, particularly in its currently sort of compromised state of example, by way of aiding China to be more open, less repressive, and more democratic. But I do think that we would all probably agree that more democracy will only help China if it's delivered in the proper doses. The question is, you know, A, can Leninist capitalism work? B, if it isn't going to be the ultimate model for China, how are they going to find a new one? And is the Chinese Communist Party going to put itself out of business at some point in favor of a more pluralistic model? That's not clear.
How do they just switch horses if it comes to that in the middle of all this booming growth, or maybe a downslide at some point? There are cycles, as everyone says. Steve is on the line. Hi, Steve. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. This is a great show.
Thank you.
Basically, I came from China, and I have been living in the United States for 5 years. I think I can say something, you know, from a different perspective.
Please.
First, you know, I don't think, you know, China is going to be, this century is going to be the so-called Chinese century. I knew that for sure, because China has a long way to go to catch up with the United States. Okay, it has a lot of problems. It has a lot of darkness sides. So, sure, I don't think this century will be the Chinese century. But, however, on the other hand, I think China has the potential to become the next giant in the world after the United States, maybe in the next century.
But you see it another 100 years off. Why don't you think it'll be in this century? You know the rate at which the Chinese economy is growing. If you just do the math.
Sorry to interrupt you.
Not at all.
Because, you know, most of you guys have, you know, already pointed out, you know, so many problems in China. I agree with that. No problem. But I think Most of your guests, sorry for saying this, most of your guests missed one point. It's what's the focus of Chinese? Okay, Chinese people are very focused people. They know what they are doing. They right now, their focus is just to get the economy growth and get a better living.
Mm-hmm.
So your guests, you know, are all talking about democracy, freedom, free religion, blah, 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 blah. I don't think, I'm a Chinese myself. I really don't think that's the current focus for most of the Chinese. Just give you an example, you know. In July 1st, Hong Kong, there was a huge demonstration on
enormous,
the street.
Yes.
Okay, and, you know, I heard just one show ask a BBC reporter, you know, the world think, you know, maybe this give Chinese people a, you know, example of how to pursue their democracy. However, the reporter, BBC reporter, who's inside China, the answer is quite simple. Because Chinese people, they just don't care. Because right now, they are 100% focusing on how to get a living life, better life. So,
and they're doing it.
Well,
our time is
caller,
running short, but we thank you, Steve, very much. Orville Schell, we hear you there.
If I could just interrupt here for a minute. I think China, you speak of democracy and freedom of religion, blah, blah, blah. I think one would have to say that one of the most errant and dangerous tendencies in Chinese history has always been extremism. A totalism, so that when the Cultural Revolution is on, politics are 200%. And when the market is reigning as it is now, we're 200% for that, and we forget about everything else. I think the question of why democracy is important is not just in its own right that it's a nice thing like a pretty ribbon in your hair, but because I think we would agree that it is one of the best ways humans have devised to overcome their problems. China's fine now. It's booming. And what when it stops booming? No civilization goes onward and upward forever. That is the point, I think, where these other values, institutions will be needed. And you do not invent these things overnight. They take a long time to inculcate.
And Ted Fishman, we just got a minute remaining. A final thought on I don't know, what comes next, where we're headed.
Well, as you know, I'm very concerned about how we mind our own game, and how we mind our own game politically is very important, as Orville Schell said. I've noticed in the recent weeks and months that the Chinese have gotten bolder in putting down their people and in civil abuses. And they get a pass when we do not act civilly in this country.
You're thinking they're doing it because Washington turns a blind eye, or because they're looking at American behavior?
We're at a time right now where we have no moral authority to assert that they ought to do better. And just as we ought to mind our economic game, in order to make a better world, a better U.S. and a better China, we have to mind our game politically, too.
Well, these are tall orders and tall challenges on all front, and a lot of excitement in the air. We'll see where it goes. Ted Fishman, it's been wonderful having you tonight. Thanks for a terrific article, and thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Ted Fishman, author of The Chinese Century in the Times Magazine, and Orville Schell in Berkeley, thanks a lot for being with us tonight and sharing your perspective. Great to have you.
Pleasure.
Orville Schell, Dean of the Graduate School of Journalism at the University of California, Berkeley, author of Mandate of Heaven, The Legacy of Tiananmen Square and the Next Generation of China's Leaders. And Jack, there it is, still surging with all those shadows that you point to. They're going to be in the face of Americans and American workers for a long time.
Yes, they are. And, of course, our government can do something about it. We have trade laws. Clinton didn't do anything about it. Bush refused to do anything about it. Some government will.
Well, we'll wait and we'll see. Listeners, you can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.